Welcome to CounselorAudioSource.net. Counselor Audio Source is a weekly podcast dedicated to the professional enhancement of practicing counselors, supervisors, and counselor educators. Look for us on the web at CounselorAudioSource.net. This week on Counselor Audio Source, Dr. Philip Rumrell, Professor of Rehabilitation, and Dr. Betsy Page, both of Kent State University, discuss clients with multiple sclerosis, its impact on the mind and body, and resources for counselors working with MS clients.
Today I have with me Dr. Phil Rumrell, and he's going to talk with us about multiple sclerosis. Welcome, and thank you for talking with us on Counselor Audio Source.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Could you start, Phil, by telling us a little bit about what MS is?
Sure thing. Multiple sclerosis is a chronic, sometimes progressive neurological disorder, one of the most common neurological disorders in the world, and more common in the Western Hemisphere than in other parts of the world. MS is characterized by lesions that occur in the central nervous system, that is the brain and the spinal cord. And essentially what happens with MS is that the immune system recognizes the myelin or insulation that covers white matter tracts in the brain and along the spinal cord. It recognizes those white matter tracts, the myelin around those white matter tracts, as foreign bodies and essentially attacks it. It really metabolizes the insulation that is provided. Myelin is a fatty tissue that surrounds nerve fibers to protect the nerve tissues and to facilitate the conduction of electrical impulses from the brain to the rest of the body via the spinal cord. What happens? The immune system turns on that myelin, metabolizes it, and it creates breaks or holes in the insulation that protects those nerves. Neurologists will often liken this process to breaks that would occur in the rubberized coating around electrical wires. If at home you have a dog that maybe chews the lamp cord or something like that, sometimes when you plug it in and turn it on, you'd hear some kind of short circuit.
So there's a break in the insulation.
That's exactly right. And what happens in that event is that the signals don't get through the way they should. Some of them are distorted. Some of them never get through, depending on where these lesions occur. So the effect of that is that the signals that don't get communicated to the rest of the body through the spinal cord from the brain and back and forth create a wide range of symptoms that are primarily determined by the location of the lesions. It's geographically where in the brain and on the spinal cord these sorts of lesions occur. For example, in the occipital lobe of the brain, if the lesions occur there, person will be likely to have visual impairments. Along certain parts of the spinal cord, lower on the spinal cord, you tend to see mobility problems, things of that nature. I'll get to some more symptoms in just a moment, but that's sort of how MS happens. And the multiple part of multiple sclerosis means that these lesions occur in at least two parts of the central nervous system. So one lesion would not be sufficient to diagnose multiple sclerosis. It's a pretty common neurological disorder, as I had mentioned before. It affects as many as 400,000 people in the United States alone. It's primarily a disease that affects women. About two-thirds of people with MS worldwide are women. People of European lineage are much more common to acquire MS than people from other racial and ethnic heritages. It's very uncommon among Asian peoples, African blacks, African Americans, Hispanics, for example, very uncommon among those groups, and much more common among people Census Bureau would call Caucasians. To give you another example, there's a geographic distribution of MS, too, and that phenomenon that if you were to divide the United States in half in terms of population, if you could draw a line above which 50% of Americans live and below which 50% of Americans live, 2/3 of people with MS would reside in the northernmost 50% of the population. So what that means is states like Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin, Minnesota, New England states particularly, have a much higher incidence of MS than do the southern states. Some of this owes to just the demographics of who lives in those states versus those, you know, in comparison to people who reside in the southern states. So you do have some demographic influence there. It's not just the weather, but we do know that MS occurs more frequently among some groups of people than others. MS is really placed in a class of a number of autoimmune disorders, and it sort of fits into those kinds of categories where the immune system doesn't behave the way that it ought to. We're not sure what really triggers the onset of MS, but there certainly is a genetic component. I mentioned the racial and ethnic information, and that's certainly a part of it. But if you have a first-generation relative, mother, father, brother, sister, who has MS, you're about 6 times more likely to acquire MS at some point in your life than someone whose first-generation family doesn't have MS. So there is a genetic predisposition, but it isn't really passed on per se in direct linear fashion. Most experts believe that the onset of MS is probably a combination of genetic susceptibility, the immunologic factors, something going wrong with the immune system, and possibly some environmental aspect to that too, whether it's a virus or something that you incur in the environment that begins to trigger the immune system sort of happening in this way. That's about as specific as we've been able to get as far as the origin of multiple sclerosis. But just given the way it onsets itself, it manifests itself, you can see that it can be very difficult to deal with. Usually occurs between the ages of 20 and 40, with the peak incidence of initial symptoms occurring at around age 30. So we're talking about women of European extraction in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, kind of in the prime of life in a whole bunch of different senses. In terms of career development and things like that, these years are often the most active ones in people's lives. And so having to deal with this at this particular point can really create some unique challenges for people as they attempt to initially deal with the illness and eventually accept it. So it comes on during this period of time, and we know this, and so it's really important to get a sense of, you know, who the demographic is, because issues of gender and race and developmental issues, like in terms of career development and things that are going on in the family and things and that during that time of life, very, very important. So we do know a lot about who gets MS. We're not entirely sure why they get it. And once MS manifests itself, we see it happening in really a number of different ways. Some people have more benign symptoms where they might incur symptoms that are similar to those of a flu once or twice a year, and that's really about it. Some people have cycles of relapses and remissions that are characteristic where the symptoms kind of wax and wane and come on and then stop for a while. And then others experience a more steadily progressive course, where you would begin to exhibit initial symptoms, and then it would just get steadily more and more progressive, you know, from that point forward. MS doesn't have a profound effect on life expectancies. Average life expectancy for men and women with MS is about 4 or 5 years lower than that of the general population. There are secondary complications. If you happen to deal with mobility issues, for example, and can't exercise and things, then you start to see kind of concomitant heart conditions and things of that nature. But people with MS generally are living into and beyond retirement, and so we have to think about planning the interventions that we deliver kind of within a life cycle context. It really affects people early to middle adulthood. And we can expect relatively full and long life expectancies. That's changed over the last few years with some of the treatments that have been available for people with MS. Really some encouraging work in that area, making the disease experience change quite a bit. I think people with MS are are retaining their functional capacities over a longer period of time than they used to, and living more comfortably and living longer. So that's a good thing. We've still got a long ways to go, and of course we haven't found the cure, which would be, which is something that's a priority for any for all the advocacy organizations and drug companies and things of that nature. But it remains a very difficult illness to deal with, and a complicated one to deal with for healthcare and mental health professionals.
So if I'm a counselor and I have clients come into me and talk about, well, maybe they're not feeling very well, you're describing a range of symptoms from pretty mild to maybe more severe. Are there any particular symptoms that should sort of be red flags that cue my thinking to maybe it's MS and maybe they should be referred for some sort of medical evaluation?
Great question. And I think the key, the answer is sometimes, but not always, I think.
Okay.
And I'll explain in just a moment. The first thing you probably want to avoid doing is offering medical diagnoses anyway, particularly for
counselors.
You know, we want to be dealing with the symptoms. If counseling is, you know, normal people dealing with normal problems that happen in the, course of human existence, then that's what we're going to be dealing with as counselors. We're going to be seeing those kinds of issues, and we want to focus there. MS is quite often diagnosed after eliminating all, you know, other explanations for the symptoms that people are experiencing. Usually, the most accurate diagnoses are conferred as a result of magnetic resonance imaging, or MRIs. These allow a picture of the lesions that occur in the brain and on the spinal cord. And anymore, it's not until those MRIs are taken where we would officially diagnose multiple sclerosis. So there's a bunch of steps that would happen between a mental health professional suggesting that they look into something more, you know, going from there. Quite often people will make trips to psychiatrists, general practitioners, internists, and many other healthcare providers before they get to a neurologist. It's sort of we rule the other things out first, I think, things that would be more readily apparent. Let me run through some of the symptoms of MS, and these aren't necessarily in order of importance with one exception. Fatigue is the unifying feature of multiple sclerosis. Almost everyone who deals with MS has some form of fatigue that's different than being worn out after a hard day's work or just being tired. It's a real kind of oppressive and really encompassing sort of fatigue that just really wipes you out in the absence of anything that has happened to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So you see that fatigue. Of course, you know that with fatigue, we will see exacerbations of certain mental health conditions, like depression, for example, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. related. Certainly, sometimes it's hard to tell which is which. High incidence of clinical depression among people with MS. Anxiety, for example, you see this quite often. Bipolar disorder, not uncommon among people with MS as well. So you'll start to see those, and those are the things that counselors would probably be dealing with first, you know, and would start seeing those kinds of things. But
the reason they would come in to see
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. But just because someone's depressed doesn't mean they have MS, or
right.
vice versa.
Right.
You know? But when you start putting those things together, then you start to look for some of the more physical neurological signs. Some of the other common symptoms include numbness and tingling, particularly in the extremities, tremors, chronic pain, hypersensitivity to heat and temperature extremes, but especially heat. People get real hot and relinquish the ability to kind of regulate their own body temperature. Again, this can then exacerbate fatigue and depression. You know, mm-hmm, it kind of goes mm-hmm. in those speech and language problems, gait problems, mobility issues, spasticity, particularly in the arms and legs, all the way up to and including paralysis, particularly in the legs, diminished strength, the physical capacity, the endurance, and those sorts of things we see a lot. Really don't want to minimize the importance of cognitive impairment, depending on where the lesions occur. About 50% of people with MS nationwide on self-report identify some difficulties with cognition, particularly in the areas of memory. Short, intermediate, and long-term memory tends to be affected, although most experts believe that general intelligence is not really affected by MS. It tends to be kind of focused in one area or another. Sexual dysfunction, bowel and bladder dysfunction, these are some of the things that counselors will be dealing with.
You could encounter.
Well. Yes, yeah. And so you, as you put these things together in constellation, remember that not everybody with MS will experience all of those symptoms, and they may experience different ones at different times. So it becomes very difficult to kind of pinpoint, and the only reasonable way we have to project the course of MS for a particular person is to look at prior experience with the disease, their prior experience. The past tends to predict the future when it comes to MS, but only at the individual level. In other words, you can't make any determination about one person's experiencing, by one person's experience by looking at another's. So the individual is very individualized. It's often unpredictable. They often don't know when the symptoms are going to come next or what they're going to be. So you can imagine the psychological
impact. That would be difficult.
Oh, it's terribly difficult. And what will happen sometimes in MS with three or four of these symptoms, even if no one of them would present what we would call significant disability. Maybe a mild tremor in one hand, okay? Maybe mild visual impairment sometimes when you're tired. Maybe fatigue, maybe a little bit of depression here and there, not all the time. So you put those things together, any one of those things we might be able to deal with. You put three or four of them together, and they can have, from a psychological perspective, a more than additive impact. You know, it's not just like adding one and two and three and four. Mm-hmm. You're dealing with them in concert. And then the memory problem comes in. And so then that starts affecting really kind of all aspects of your life. The psychological reaction often seems to be excessive, if this makes any sense. It's not necessarily commensurate with the observations we would make about what's going on. People say, well, I'm doing okay, things at home are fine here and there, and you'll find them really kind of what seems to be almost overreacting. This is not uncommon. We talk with counselors and rehabilitation professionals who say that people with MS tend to kind of overreact to stimuli in their environment. I think there's two main reasons for this that we really do need to be aware of. One is, even in its most benign form, this is a lousy thing to have happen to you. It's intrusive, It interferes. It's frustrating. Remember, we've got successful, well-educated, well-trained, effective folks, by and large, who deal with this thing and don't know how to go about, solving these new problems. So it's a frustrating condition to deal with from an adjustmental perspective and interjects a bunch of environmental stress into our lives. Second, remember the organic elements of MS, that it's caused by damage to the brain and the central nervous system. So if the part of the brain that governs mood, social judgment, speech and communication, things like that, if those things are affected, if that's where the lesions occur, we've got an organically based response as well that can in fact exacerbate things like depression or anxiety even beyond where they would be otherwise. So it's sort of that dual interaction. Not uncommon with other autoimmune disorders or with other mental health disorders, right? We don't know whether it's organic and chemical or whether it's, life being life, And I think that's really the difficult part. The main marker, though, is fatigue, and it's fatigue that doesn't go away, and it's a continued approach to find out kind of what the problem is and different kinds of things being, often MS is confused for psychiatric disorders, Right, we'll tend to, and we'll deal with the psychiatric issues, and those might go away for, and those might alleviate for a period of time, but the person's still going to be dealing with fatigue. I'm not feeling depression so much because I've taken some antidepressants and I'm getting counseling,
but I'm still exhausted.
I'm wiped out, right? A bowel and bladder, sexual dysfunction, and my memory's off. And it's at that point, I think, that the counselor may want to suggest, if the signs start, I think it's the neurologically oriented signs, the tremors. The spasticity, the visual impairment. Those are the things that make you think about MS. Because if you have a condition and if you have these other symptoms and they're not about those things, you're going to just probably deal, and even knowing if it's MS, what good does it do you anyway if all they're dealing with are affective issues and things like that? You got to help them deal with that no matter what. But as you see other signs, that wouldn't be explained by virtue of those affective issues just in isolation, that's when we want to look to the next step. I would also strongly encourage counselors of all types and from all backgrounds to really refer the client back to their primary care physician or whomever it is, and helping them in some ways, I think, because it's really quite empowering to take control over your healthcare, So from that standpoint, and over what happens to you medically. So I think even helping sometimes, just to kind of the worksheets, the checklists, write down all your symptoms for just like as if you're helping somebody lose weight, you'd have them diagram everything they ate for a month. I think that's keeping track and journaling what symptoms came when, so that they can bring that then to the doctor instead of having to answer those same questions
and,
over again.
Write down what you want to ask the
doctor. And I think that's a very important role that a counselor can play. Also, keeping track of the impact of this thing and of the symptoms on other aspects of your life. People between the ages of 20 and 40, what's going on at that time? Often they have children. They're kind of moving up the career ladder and things like that. Nowadays, we're having to take responsibility for our aging parents, and we're going in all this, a sandwich generation, We're really busy, got a lot of things going on, and keeping track of how things are affecting, you in your marriage or whatever relationship, what other relationships you may have, relationships with your children, significant others, coworkers, and keeping track of that, and keeping track of how things, seem to be affecting you, particularly, I think, from the standpoint of fatigue and how you're feeling psychologically is very, very important. And then from there, the counselor can really start seeing, is it really focused in an adjustment issue, or do we need to be looking at the some other things? And those some other things are the ones that would look more like the neurological signs, like I was saying. Physiological signs, I guess, of neurological problems, and go from there. Remember, there's a whole class of autoimmune disorders that at least have some element of the immune system kind of turning on itself. Arthritis, Lyme's disease, Crohn's disease, Graves' disease, it goes on and on. And these are conditions that, lupus, that involve the immune system not working the way that it ought to. It's not uncommon for them to onset during that period of time. So, they do share some similar symptoms. I think one thing that's unique about MS is the wide range of symptoms. Nothing's off limits to MS because every part of physical, psychological, and social functioning can be affected by MS depending on where those lesions occur, because you're talking about the brain and spinal cord, which are intimately involved in everything we do. So it can kind of go in all of those different directions, which can really kind of redouble the frustration that somebody might be experiencing. Complicated, clinical presentation this condition really does have. And again, I think the first answer is keeping in mind, our own scope of practice. What is it that we do? What kinds of problems do we help people with? And the tendency is when you get when someone's in distress for whatever reason, they don't stop to think about, oh, well, this person's a social worker. They can't do this or this. They don't think this person's a community counselor, this person's a rehab counselor, or this person's a psychiatrist. They'll take any help they can get, And it's up to us, I think, not them, to figure out where we ought to be referring and what things we ought to be doing. So understanding our own boundaries in terms of our own strengths and limitations, in terms of the things we're able to do, is really key, perhaps especially with this group of people who are dealing with symptoms that might be the purview of 6, 8, 10 different professionals. And so it's really important to focus on the things we do them well. And I think the key is in this really is helping people to really kind of arm themselves and protect themselves as much as they can against this disease by taking as much control over their lives as they possibly can, which is why most people come to counseling, I think.
Now, you were saying sort of at the beginning when you were talking that life expectancy is full, and that there were some new developments in terms of treatments and so on.
Yes.
When we get to the point where they've worked their way through the diagnostic process and someone is diagnosed with MS, could you talk a little bit about what kinds of treatments might be available?
Yes. The class of medications that seem to work the best are what are called the beta blockers and beta interferon classes of medication. A number of brand names you'll see very commonly: Avonex, Betaseron, Copaxone, Rebif. And these are mostly meant to interrupt the cycle of the disease and essentially slow or extend periods of remission for people who have the cycle, the cyclical form of the illness where you have symptoms for a while and then it stops. And these tend to work best for people with the relapsing remitting forms of MS, and they essentially slow or extend the periods of remission and essentially prevent relapses. For people who have a more progressive form of the illness, these medications, tend not to work quite so well. And in those cases, or when the beta interferon drugs do not really work to extend the remissions, when the symptoms do come back, then we treat the symptoms. We treat them with things like vitamin A, particularly for visual impairments and things like that, with steroids, especially prednisone, but many different kinds of steroids, tissue-building drugs, for example, to help perhaps jumpstart the regrowth of nerve tissue, if that's possible, things of that nature. And then treating the symptoms in other ways, other kinds of pharmacological interventions, antidepressants and things like that, mm-hmm. Anti-anxiety medication, to deal with the specific symptoms themselves, muscle relaxants when we're dealing with spasticity and things of that nature. So there are kind of two classes of medication. One is to essentially block the disease from coming back, block the symptoms from flaring up again. And we've had some really remarkable success with some of those medications. Not for everybody. Sometimes people have to try one or the other. A lot of those medications that I mentioned do have significant side effects. So you really want, your client really needs to sometimes experiment to find the right combination of those things. So that's one to kind of deal with the actual nature of the illness. And then the other medications are ones that would be more familiar to many of us, because those would be to deal specifically with symptoms as they occur. That tends to be the approach. There's no cure for MS, but there have been people who have reported, seemingly permanent or long-term remissions as a result of the right combination of medications. But this is usually arrived upon after long periods of trial and error, and trying to, medication prescriptions is as much of an art as a science, really. And sometimes they just have to be willing to try the treatments. And again, people's neurologists, are really the specialists who deal mostly with MS. If you haven't been able to get your symptoms under control by seeing your general practitioner, I really encourage people to seek the care of a neurologist who has specialty training in multiple sclerosis. At many places around the country, there are MS centers or MS clinics that are located in hospitals and larger clinics, and strongly recommend that people go and see someone who's a specialist in MS if they're having difficulty getting the right combination of treatments. Sometimes the treatments will work well for a while, and then they'll stop working, and so it's an ongoing process. Now, there are a lot of other things that you'll find, particularly like to deal with the fatigue, for example, relaxation training, things of that nature, taking control of other aspects of one's both mental and physical health, very, very important kinds of things. Naps during the day sometimes is a helpful thing for people, knowing that you're going to need perhaps more rest, or having rest that can be as effective as possible, and making sure that you're allowing enough time for that, structuring your day, time management kinds of things, all kinds of relaxation and stress management sorts of things, really very important as well. And then, not just in terms of medical treatment, but surrounding oneself with the assistive technology that they might need, motorized scooters or wheelchairs to get them around if the mobility is an issue, magnification for computer screens, glare guards if that's an issue for your computer so you don't get headaches from having to get too close to the monitor and things of that nature, all kinds of stabilizers for your hand and things of that nature, left-handed or right-handed keyboards or a trackball mouse to get around instead of manipulating the mouse in a fine motor context, all the way down to low-tech solutions like certain kinds of canes for mobility. Very common to see people with MS using these sorts of things, mm-hmm. and in-home aids as well. Not so much as a treatment for the symptoms. It doesn't change the symptoms, but it really helps to alleviate how intrusive the symptoms are. So it's very important, I think, to for people to be aware of those and to point them in the direction of resources that can help in that way as well.
You were talking to me also about leading support groups, and could you say a little bit about the importance of support and care partners and that aspect?
Very important. I mean, multiple sclerosis, like any significant chronic illness, doesn't just happen to the person. It happens to everyone around him or her. And so the family, your significant others and your friends, I mean, these people are affected just as you are by this particular condition. And it's really important to, perhaps more important when something like this is going on, that self-monitoring I mentioned earlier, keeping track of what's going on symptomatically, but also, even if you didn't have to communicate much about these kinds of things, finding those people you can talk things through with, knowing what it is you can share and what you can't. Do you want to talk about this at work and your boss finds out? Maybe, maybe not. Do you have close friends you can rely on? Is this something that your husband or your wife or your significant other can help you with? Is that the kind of relationship? So you have to kind of get a little more objective and critical about the relationships in your life and what you can, you know, from who, for, what can you depend on whom for? You know, I mean, I'm mm-hmm, not saying that mm-hmm. right, but, you know, who can meet your needs in which of these ways and what things are you being called upon to do and what kinds of supports are out there? I think that's really kind of understanding your own social capital and knowing who's available to help you. Very, very important. Support groups, I think, are very important. A lot of support groups you'll see in medium and large size towns and cities. The National Multiple Sclerosis Society has 88 chapters in the 50 United States. And they have support groups literally all over the United States of people with MS, sometimes to talk through these issues with people who are going through it at the very same time. Families and friends are welcome to attend these support groups as well. A lot of other educational activities. People with MS do a lot of reading. There's a big self-help movement within the MS society. But sometimes people feel that the only people who can really understand what they're going through are people who have gone through that as well. And that's where the support groups come in. And the MS Society, National Multiple Sclerosis Society, does a great job of organizing these support groups. And your clients could find one as well if they wanted to talk through. And sometimes you can hear from others solutions that they've figured out in other ways and ways that might help you, helping others by helping yourself. And some of the things that you've figured out along the way might be able to help somebody else. So these are a really powerful way of getting that kind of support, usually run by a skilled facilitator from the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. And I've just found, you know, people with MS tell us this is a great way to get that kind of support because it's a hard illness to understand if you haven't gone through it on your own.
So the Multiple Sclerosis Society is a really important resource for folks. And I'm wondering if you could talk just briefly about a few resources you might recommend for counselors and also for people who have or want to understand MS. And I want to say here on the audio program that we'll post those also on counselaudiosource.net, so there would be links or written information if somebody wants to follow up on this.
Terrific. The National Multiple Sclerosis Society, and we'll post their website, both at the, and each chapter has its own website as well. But if you visit their national website, they have just a tremendous amount of information on medical aspects of MS, psychosocial aspects, a lot of written brochures, consumer's guide to health insurance, portability, consumer's guide to employment, to the Americans with Disabilities Act, a number of these that are written specifically for people with MS. It's a wonderful resource. The medical publisher Demos, D-E-M-O-S, has done a number of excellent books for medical health care, mental health professionals on multiple sclerosis. Good current editions of those texts is another way to get really good information as well. If you're dealing with people with MS, one of the big issues for people in that age bracket is employment. And I would encourage counselors to think about if there's any kind of difficulty around employment that your clients with MS or people who might have MS are experiencing. The state vocational rehabilitation program, which is located in each of the 50 states as well, be a great referral to make. They can provide and pay for job placement services, retraining, career counseling, things of that nature, specifically for people with disabilities. Help people to reformulate their career goals. If they need accommodations or other technology, that's another excellent resource. Case managers who have government funds available to help people with the employment arena. In terms of assistive technology to help people to become more comfortable in their daily lives, the Technology Act, what we call the Tech Act, has at least one project in every state in America that is designed to put assistive technology into the hands of people with disabilities, both for their homes and for independent living and for employment, a very important resource as well. And we can create some links to these assistive technology projects. The Job Accommodation Network is another excellent resource for people having difficulty with employment, particularly in terms of accommodations they might need. And there's a lot of transfer between accommodations people would need in work and those that they might be able to benefit from in the home. We'll help people with MS and other disabilities to solve those problems through technology solutions, through other things, and give them ideas about how to go about requesting accommodations from their employers. Focusing a little bit on employment here, only because it's such a major issue. 95 to 98% of Americans with MS have employment histories, means they've worked at some point in the past. About three quarters are still working at the time of diagnosis. But as time and the illness progress, one's prospects for continued employment seem to really deteriorate, particularly in the first 5 to 7 years after diagnosis. Only 25 to 40% of people with MS, depending on the study you read, in America today are currently employed for pay. So we see this real disengagement and mass exodus, if you will, from the workforce. And what we'd like to do in an early intervention context is help people with MS to get everything else that's going on in their lives in enough of a sense of order and control where employment doesn't have to be the thing, because employment is our vehicle for most of us anyway to income, to health insurance coverage, mm-hmm. Socialization, you know, all the benefits of employment. And most people with MS who are unemployed tell us they'd like to go back into the workforce but don't know how to after disengaging. It's much easier to help someone keep the job they've got than to help them find another one. And most people want to keep the jobs they have. So that's a very, very important issue. And I guess that's one I would be attuned to in counseling as well, is look for anything that has to do with kind of vocational kinds of issues. They're very likely to come up based on those statistics I just cited. And we got to be prepared to deal with them very proactively, because if people disengage from the workforce, every day that someone with MS doesn't go back into, every day they're staying home and not working, reduces the likelihood they ever will, because they get on Social Security, long-term disability insurance, and things like
that. So early intervention is real important around staying in the workforce.
Staying in the workforce and, I might say, around the mental health aspects of MS as well, right? I mean, get it started as soon as possible. Don't wait until tomorrow to hope you might be feeling better. Take control of it today, and I think we can be encouraging our clients to do that. We'll help them to deal with this illness much more effectively.
You spoke to me about a book that you would recommend if somebody were to only read one book. You talked about
yes,
MS and the questions. Could you talk just a couple minutes about
There's
that?
There's a terrific book edited by Dr. Rosalind Kalb, K-A-L-B, and the book is called Multiple Sclerosis, The Questions You Have, The Answers You Need. And it's probably a 500 or 600-page text that has gathered the most common questions that professionals from all areas of education, human services, healthcare, law have received from people with MS in the words of people with multiple sclerosis. And then Dr. Kalb has experts from around the world really answering those questions. So plain English questions, plain English answers. And it's a tremendous source book. The most recent edition of this book, I think, was published in 2004. And it's published by Demos. I mentioned them before, out of New York. And if people are going to have one book to read or just wanted one in a single source, this really cuts across from psychological issues to family to independent living and transportation to employment to treatment matters, new research on MS, things of that nature, all organized by the questions that people with MS have. It's a terrific resource. It's written in plain English, very clear, and has tons and tons of resources. Each chapter has a list of websites and references to access for additional information. Be a great primer also.
Wonderful place to begin.
For counselors too.
For counselors as well.
Yes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
Finding this very educative, and I'm sure it will help everybody who listens. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You've just heard an interview with Dr. Philip Rumroll regarding working with multiple sclerosis clients, done by Counselor AudioSource contributing editor Dr. Betsy Page. Look for previous podcasts, show notes, and listener feedback on the podcast website at counselloraudiosource.net. Listeners can leave comments or questions for our interview guests or hosts through our Skype.com internet telephone ID, Counselor Audio Source, or by calling 330-871-4015. Counseling techniques and interventions discussed in the Counselor Audio Source broadcast are meant for use by counseling professionals, and Counselor Audio Source is not held liable for any use of the techniques mentioned in the program. Our music bed today is Memorial Day from Jamie Beauchamp. His and other PodSafe music can be found in the PodSafe Music Network at podshow.com. Counselor Audio Source is licensed under the Creative Commons, a nonprofit organization offering a flexible copyright for creative work.